You don't own me. Don't try to change me in any way. You don't own me. Don't tie me down, 'cause I'd never stay.
It's time for the Daily Review, a podcast dedicated to reviews and discussion of TV, movies, and books. Look for us at Daily Review on Facebook and Twitter and dailyreview.com on the web. That's DaleyReview.com.
This is Paul Daly, here with my wife, Caroline.
Hey, guys.
And we're here today to talk about the fifth episode of Handmaid's Tale. This one is called Faithful.
So Faithful, I looked it up. I was trying to figure out if there was any other way that we could use Faithful that maybe just didn't come to mind right away. Obviously, we have the situation with Luke and June in this one and the concept of faithfulness to one's marriage.
Right.
That's obviously a huge part. What else did you see the word faithful coming up?
This whole government and new system of existing is very faith-based on their one single religion. Faithful, you don't usually use that word to mean religious, but it could mean faith.
Well, I mean, it says staunch, suggests fortitude and resolution in adherence and imperviousness to influences that would weaken it. That's also a definition of faithful. Like, I was like, oh, I always only think of it as like loyal or really faithful. I think of in a marriage, you know, like, are you being faithful like that? Because I use other words when I try to mean loyalty and trust and that kind of stuff. I don't use the word faithful. Mm-hmm. I use the word loyal. But they kind of, at least in the dictionary, they act like those words are completely interchangeable. But I also found it the concept of fortitude and resolution with faithful to be like, oh, okay. Like, I mean, that's like keep on keeping on, you know? That's a real different word again.
That makes sense. Because given what Serena Joy propositions, it kind of, on the one hand, would imply a certain lack of faith in the system, but would go along with what you're saying of being a staunch, because we know that she...
Staunch is a word I would use for Serena Joy.
We know that her primary motivation is getting that baby made, right?
I guess. I mean, it's so confusing, but I'll say I guess.
Another word, but I don't know where it plays in here, is reliable. The reason they call Old Faithful is because it is reliable.
Very true. Very true. So again, I wouldn't necessarily use that word interchangeably with faithful, but again, you're right. I mean, that's what they call the geyser in Yellowstone. So therefore, it should be interchangeable.
Maybe in this case, Nick is Old Faithful.
Good call. Interesting. So I totally encourage you guys to look back through the episode and try to find different ways to use it. I think that these titles are very simple on the surface, but I think if you go and you really look at the definitions and then you really search through the episode, I think you can find that simple words like faithful can really be twisted in a whole bunch of different ways, especially to me, you know, applying faithful to a marriage and then applying faithful to Serena Joy feels very different, you know? Mm-hmm. So, all right, let's start off with those flashbacks that we get with how June and Luke meet. First of all, here's our first indicator that Tinder is a hot thing for everybody. That was something Aunt Lydia kind of snarkily added during her Red Center opening comments to the girls, was like, everyone's on Tinder, like everything's so ugly and gross. What do you think of this meeting of Luke and their subsequent lunches?
Well, the way that they meet is very, you know, just happenstance. They meet like a lunch truck. And it seems like perhaps that Moira has come across this Tinder profile just by accident, because she seems very intent on embarrassing June about the whole thing. Her picture, maybe even the fact that she has a Tinder account, the whole thing. Because she's very laughy and like takes her phone, gives it to this stranger, like pick a better picture, you know, all that kind of stuff.
It seemed very realistic to me as like two girlfriends with like, you know, specifically for June, you know.
Oh, I didn't say it was like mean-spirited or contrived.
No, just... but I don't think that she like just, I didn't take it like she just found out June's on Tinder or anything. Just that it was one of those things where June's probably been complaining like, oh my God, I keep going out with these lamos. And she's like, well, you know, it's not the type of thing that you necessarily have looked at your friend's dating profile. And so, you know, maybe you did take a look then. You're like, what the hell? What what is this doggy picture you put? Or what are these goofy answers you put? This is not going to get anybody cool. Did you think Luke was pretty flirty with the, you know, you look invincible?
Oh, for sure. You could use a lot of words that are kind of expected in that situation because he's already done something unexpected, which was he took a long time going from picture to picture in another person's phone.
Oh, and he like hooked into when Moira was like, I'm not going to show him your nudies. And he made some little comment like, oh, are those in here?
But then using the word invincible, that I think would speak to a stranger woman in a way that hot wouldn't. You know what I mean?
I agree. I mean, it does separate him from like a chump guy, right? A chump guy would say hot or something silly like that. And then, you know, him saying invincible is like, oh, you know, you're attracted to strength. Oh, you know, and that immediately obviously puts him at complete odds with the commander and everything Gilead stands for. I mean, he would be attracted to a strong woman, someone who is invincible. Whoa. I mean, this is really the opposite of everything Fred is. What do you think about this idea that they're going for lunches? He didn't tell Annie his wife. June's not telling Moira. And they have this like talking above board conversation about like, so how would having an affair happen? Like, what would that look like per se?
They're fooling themselves, obviously. I mean, come on now.
Would you ever be that cool, though, to be like, now, how does it happen in the movies? How does anyone ever have an affair in a movie? Would you be that slick? Because I thought it was pretty smooth.
Yeah, I think I've been on the receiving end of those tricks. Wink, wink. It's a way to bring something up in a way that seemed removed from yourself, but then allowing you to kind of also play act inside that idea. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it's super interesting because we've already been seeing all this language in Gilead that seems like this really fake phrases and fake, like you mean something else, but you say these like prescribed phrases. And in a way, it makes me think about how they're talking, like they're not really talking about what's going on, but yet they are. I thought that that's kind of like a cool juxtaposition there of saying, like, you know, in modern day times, you know, men and women talk to each other in these very cryptic ways. And I feel like even in Gilead, you know, may the Lord open, you know, be a flower that, I mean, it's all cryptic too. They try to make it sound sort of this with this biblical overtone. Whereas, you know, here we have Luke and June using these like movie references and things like that, that are very, you know, maybe more fun
or innocuous. Like if someone overhears you having either one of those conversations, just like a phrase or something like that, no one's going to think this person is doing something they're not supposed to do.
Right. Aunt Lydia didn't just say, go in there and spread your legs, because that would sound awful, right? But right. If she says, be open like a flower, then that, okay, fine. You know, that sounds cool. Luke and June, if they're talking about a movie, well, you know, they're just saying, oh, characters in a movie would go to a seedy motel and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Again, you're right. Like, this is some ways to disguise your conversation. Did you catch that they seem to be wearing the same clothes?
No.
I was paying a lot of attention to what June was wearing for her outfit. And despite the fact that she said 48 hours, she was wearing the same flowery top and the same jacket when they're in the hotel room as when they're at that lunch.
Ah.
There's no 48 hours. And there was no lingerie she went and purchased. Like, that was all just foreplay talk.
You knew that the situation had turned when he said we could go to the Hyatt. Like, he took it from the hypothetical and took it to a very specific real world, well, this is how we could do it kind of thing.
How did you feel about them going to the hotel and us getting all the way to the point where June straight up says, I want you to leave your wife, and him being like, okay. And she being like, what are you talking about? Like, that was way too easy. And him being like, well, I'm in love with you, so what else am I going to do? Did that seem remotely realistic? Like, we didn't get that dance of like, things aren't working out between me and Annie. Like the usual crap that you get. We got zero. We just got like, I'm madly in love with you, therefore I'm going to leave my other person. Without any comment that like things are going badly with that other person.
I'm going to lean on the idea that this was an economical approach to getting that stuff said without saying it.
Okay.
By being so bold, so upfront with, okay, I'll leave her. It kind of says a lot. Now, it could also say some other stuff like, I'm a piece of shit and I'll do this to you and, you know, stuff like that. But I'm not led to think that about him personally.
I think that's a super good question. The name of the show is Faithful. So, you know, once a cheater, always a cheater.
That's what they say in Maury Povich.
We hear that kind of stuff all the time. You know, do husbands change? Does a guy who's in a committed relationship who then is off having lunches and lying about it, saying he's having lunch at his desk? I feel like every single wife who watched that and earlier that day their husband said, oh, I ate lunch at my desk today, probably got a shiver up her spine of like, what? You know, like, I don't know about that. I don't know. I mean, do you think that Luke is a good guy? Do you feel like we are feeling good about him?
Well, this is definitely a blemish. I mean, I know that he's doing this for our hero, the protagonist, June. However, he's still leaving a wife. Now, there could be hashtag reasons that we're just supposed to just assume, maybe, which is what I'm doing. Now, he doesn't seem old. He doesn't seem young enough to have one of those, well, got married too young kind of wives that
well,
you
it's possible.
About.
I mean, they could have been married for 10 years or something. You know, I mean, who knows how long.
Yeah,
he's
but those
been married
too young marriages dissolve quicker than that.
Oh, I don't know.
10 years. It takes 10 years to realize we got married too young.
I don't know. I don't know anything about how long they've been married or anything, but it's just, it's worrisome to me. And I don't want to feel played as the watcher. So I feel a little bit like I can pull back from this. I'm not going to get all caught up in like that. Oh, this is so fun. And June is so cute. And I mean, you know, she's a straight up, you know, homewrecker. Like that is the definition of homewrecking, right? Is to know that this person's married, understand this person's married, and pursue the situation, and then straight up saying, "Leave your wife." I mean, hello. I mean, that's there's nothing tricky about that.
For anyone that hasn't put the dotted lines together, this is why she's referred to as a slut in the Gilead society, is because it is known on some level that this is how her relationship came to be. She seduced a married man and their child was a product of this second marriage without the first spouse dying and all this other kind of stuff. But that is why she gets that label in the Gilead society, and there's nothing she can do about it.
Speaking of nothing she could do about it, right? We get back to our scenario with the commander. And this is a much different interaction between her and the commander. We see the same flirtiness nature, but at the same time, it feels very fake.
You know how when you're in a group setting and someone sits in a chair backwards, you know, and it's sort of like that, hey, we're all bros here, we're all talking, we're all just doing. Well, that is kind of how she was sitting on the floor playing Scrabble. She wasn't.
Yeah, she had her shoes off and she was wearing nylons.
Kind of hiked up a little bit.
And did you notice that the commander wasn't wearing a suit? He was wearing just like a black undershirt kind of shirt and like black pants, but it was much more similar to something you would see Nick wear, not what you would ever see the commander wear.
So things have gotten very cash on
very
Scrabble night.
Very cash on Scrab night, yeah.
He says he has a present for her, and it is what looks to be a modern for today fashion magazine. Its name isn't one that is...
It's called Beautify.
Yeah. This is something that happened in the book, and it's interesting. She's like, does seem to want to look through it.
Well, of course you would. I mean, my God, you would be like sensory deprivation situation. You know, I mean, she was an editor at a book place. I mean, oh my God, you would just want to read it, even though it's like foolishness. I thought it was really cool how they explained, you know, God, the models all look insane. They look like animals who don't know they're about to go extinct. You know, it's all wow. And I like how they actually use the little quiz, because I'm all about the quizzes in the magazines. I'm like definitely like an autumn and all that kind of good stuff. I really enjoy when she started using it, like, you know, how do you know he's into you? Number one, he brings you small gifts.
Yeah, right.
I kind of wish that had proceeded through the entire episode, because she does it one more time pertaining to Nick, but then it just falls off.
This reminded me quite a bit of something that happened in the Facebook group that we're a part of, the Gilead Online Facebook group, where someone posted pictures from a pre-Ayatollah Iran fashion catalog that featured Iranian women wearing like mini dresses, like down to the bottom of your butt and that's it, kind of mini dresses.
Yeah, it was eye-opening to us because that would have been before we were born. And it's amazing that that culture has changed what we know today as Iran has nothing to do with what it was and how, you know, drastic the women's treatment was. Right, you know, it is amazing. It is amazing. And I'm very thankful that our group is very international on Facebook. So there's a lot of us here in America and a lot of younger viewers. I would say if you're 40 or less, you don't know that much about pre-Iran that we all know current. And I think that, I mean, it's been so helpful. Another girl that's on there said she was from South Africa and she was explaining how, you know, people were asking, you know, well, how long would it take you before you just like hauled ass and got out of there? And she was like, you knowing you need to leave and being able to leave are very different situations. She said that her and her husband, they feel they are connected to their country. They don't want to abandon their country. They need to stay because that's where they belong. But at the same time, it's like, oh my God, you know, what is happening here? It's insane. So I really appreciate the international level of our group and that people are straying from the politics part of it and really talking about the cultural parts of it. Because to me, that's where the rubber meets the road. Like, we actually don't know much about the politics of this government, I say in air quotes, of Gilead. We just understand more about the culture and about the society they've created, but not the politics per se,
right?
Which is very, very different. So like, we shy away completely from talking about politicians and more to talk about cultural things. I know one thing that I look out for my girls is they had some really cool t-shirts online that were like, essentially, if you look at the front of the t-shirt, it is drawn where it looks like two arms are holding a book. So it's like when the girl is like wearing the t-shirt, it looks like she's holding a book in front of her. Mm-hmm. And those types of things are so rare as opposed to how many times you see like a kitten or something on the front. Whereas I can tell you for my son, there are 1,000 choices with math computations, NASA, robots, all kinds of things on it that are far more, I'm going to say, thought-provoking than the rainbows and kittens and just sit down, pat your little pretty head that are on our girls' clothes. And I think that cultural things like that, like you said about Iran, fascinating. So this magazine brings all those things. It's really a glimpse into our culture previous.
And she can't resist. She opens it up, leafs through it, looks at the quiz, like you mentioned.
You know what wigged me really out? How much he liked watching her read. It's like men who like to watch women like eat something or like those kind of fetishy things. He actually enjoyed having the power of taking away reading and giving back reading. Like, reading became like a sexy fetish.
See, for my own self, if I give a person something, it gives me some comfort to know that they are putting whatever it is to some good use, whether they need it or they give it to somebody that needs it or whatever. It's nice to know that part. However, I don't want to stick around and watch it, you know, because that feels creepy to me. Like, I've given it and I've given it openly. So, you know, it's up to you now. The idea of taking it in and having that feed me, like, I'm so glad I did this for you. It that doesn't work for me.
I take it in a more sexual way. Like, again, like, I'm not the type of person who wants to watch you eat, but there are men who like to sit there and watch you like eat a banana. And that's like a sexy thing and stuff like
that. Well, gross. Popsicles are a totally other thing.
Oh, shut your mouth. Like, for me, all I can hear is slurping and I'm like, get the fuck away from me. Like, my misophonia is like off the chart right now. If I hear one more mouth sound, I'm going to punch you in the face. I can't stand it. It's not sexy to me. Talk about what's super not sexy to me is SJ's new plan of how to get June pregnant.
Yeah, she wants to augment the typical
sperm situation.
Yeah, she wants to.
Let's get some more swimmers in that birth canal.
Yeah. And so she's recruited poor Nick. Poor unwilling Nick.
Oh, yeah. He's so, so unwilling. So how do you like how he's like creeping around when he knows SJ's going to present this plan? He's like, I'm just in here washing my hands. I'm in no way sizing you up.
It did, on my second watch, it did make me realize, oh yeah, he knows what she's about to ask.
And not only that, but like, he's like washing up. like right in front of her before she even knows what's happening. He's like washing his hands, you know, like.
Mm-hmm. Right. Doesn't want greasy hands.
Super gross. That conversation out in the garden where we're like listening to June's thoughts and she's all like, I could just stab these shears right into her neck. Oh, boy. I wonder how many times you would have those thoughts. Probably every second of every day.
Well, she's in survival mode. And I applaud her, actually, for getting to this area where she is starting to look at things in terms of what's the best way to survive this moment. Should I kill her? Actually, no, that's not a great way to survive this moment. But if I had to kill her, this is how I would do it.
I thought it was kind of crazy that they went to Nick's apartment. Didn't that seem like a really bad idea? Because Nick's allowed to be in the house. But there is zero reason why June or SJ should be in Nick's apartment. So didn't that seem like inherently like a bad idea to go to his apartment? I mean, I know there's noises and I know you need to maybe be concerned about that. But the way that we said there's guardians like outside with like the machine guns and stuff outside the gate, like, doesn't it seem like watching this parade up into Nick's apartment, which was like totally out in the open, seem like a really questionable idea?
Those are the only two dangerous points, though. I mean, his house is above the garage and it's got the one point of entry that we know about. So as long as you're quick and no one sees you, then you don't have other household staff or whatever that could go wrong inside the house.
I guess that's true.
So, but yeah, you're right. The transit part would be...
Would you have at least waited till night or something?
Why would you two be going there now?
Yeah, I wonder if they had any kind of... It seems like they should have had like some lunch to deliver in their hands or I don't know, something.
Or a paid off guard.
Or, oh, know, no. Something. Oh, no. I don't think that's a thing. No, no. I'm not going in for that. I don't think you could pay off any guards right now. Mm-mm-mm-mm. So no prayers, no time. Serena Joy's just going to kind of glance out the window. And Nick's bed is a lot more weebly than the Waterford's bed. It's like, like, it is so creaky. And I kind of think that June's more into this one. She seems like a little more flushed during this ceremony.
Or they didn't give her any voiceover to suggest that her mind was elsewhere, did they?
No, they really didn't. Every time, I swear to God, do you think that they amplify the clanking of the belts when the men take off their belts?
Yeah.
Because it is so loud.
Yeah.
I mean, right. Obviously it's meant to be like ominous, which I'm afraid for the whole world that it's going to be kind of like screwing up, you know, young women's brains, maybe who like haven't had sex yet or something, that when you hear clanking of the belts, you should like freak the fuck out. Like, okay.
So like decent guys will have to start wearing like those canvas belts
or no belts at all. Suspenders. Maybe suspenders will make a comeback because of this. That actually seems very reasonable, Paul. We call them schlakies in Lithuanian. Nothing sexier than a man in Schlakey's, Paul.
Serena has arranged for this blessed day to be one of, shall we say, double dipping.
Oh, God.
Because it is also ceremony night at the Waterfords. However, Fred gets a little, if it's, this is kind of weird to say during a sexual act, but he gets a little fresh.
He does. I mean, he was intently staring at her. And the thigh move, watching Offer try to like shake her head back and forth and be like, quit it, don't, what are you doing? Like, what if Serena Joy sees you? Like, oh my God. Do you think Serena Joy did kind of see out of the corner of her eye?
No, she was intently looking elsewhere and they kept showing us that she was looking elsewhere. So no, I don't think she saw that.
So what were your takeaways from this conversation, which was pretty layered and quite a lot of information was passed out.
The conversation had several phases. The first one being June was pissed that there was this breach of protocol with the touching of her thigh. And that was right there on the surface. You're not supposed to do that. You could get us both in serious trouble. All that stuff that he said later, right after that, actually, about biological destinies, told us a lot about the commander and what he thought about the nature of men and women and, in his mind, the place of men and women.
Definitely. He thought that women's biological destiny was to have children, and that was their entire focus.
Super clear why non-heterosexuals would then be cast-offs Because absolutely. If you're not fulfilling your biological destiny, you are not useful to us.
And even why he'd be attracted to Serena Joy, because ironically, she is in a powerful position over in the modern world or back in our before Gilead world because of her talking about how you should stay at home. So it's like such a weird paradox because she has like seemingly like some sort of career and like speaking career and books and stuff by saying you should stay home and just raise kids. But like here she is writing books and having a career.
Yeah, she's
not raising kids.
The queen of irony, I think, in this
absolutely.
Story.
What did you think about the fact that he knew what Emily's punishment was?
This is a first glimpse into a little bit of how the government works. And even people like him who, I mean, it seems like everybody has every job in this in a way. So no one's like the minister of that or the director of this. Everyone seems to know. Or just, you know, discuss everything else.
Is that believable?
No, not for a government.
Because supposedly it's as big as the entire U.S.? That's what I've been
chief
reading.
Chief executives, you know, like a governor or something, is expected to know a little bit about everything, I think. But, I mean, it doesn't make a sense that he would be in on deciding the punishment of a handmaid.
And it's been a part of our kind of question mark this entire time. Like Aunt Lydia, same deal. Everywhere, all the time, running everything. Like they only seem to have one representative to the audience of what has to be a much larger body of people. We only see Aunt Lydia as the face of everything that goes on for the handmaids. I mean, everything. And then we really only see Waterford as like our front man, you know, the person who's going to give us much of anything. But yet his hand is supposed to be in everything. You'd think she would have gotten that information, honestly, from another handmaid. I mean, they talk. They have all that, like, don't you listen? Do you listen? You know, that kind of stuff. Like, listen in your house. You'd think that there would have been a rumor.
He wasn't overly descriptive about what they did.
I know. It was a little weird.
But the way that he phrased it, he believed in what they did.
Well, and here's the other thing on that. Apparently, going back to way the beginning of a lot of the Facebook conversations, what he said was even like a misnomer because he really doesn't understand body parts very well. I'm going to let you guys do a lot of looking that up because I don't want to misquote anything. But generally speaking, the part of the body that he is referring to is much larger internally and much more expansive than the male counterpart, apparently. And so it's,
say what?
Yeah. So it's one of those things when he said, oh, it's a tiny problem. Like that's an ignorant comment. What do you think about his biggest, baddest comment here?
The actor's delivery of this line can be read a couple different ways. You could look at his face when he says it and read something along the lines of, I wish this wasn't true, but it is. Or you could read something like, yeah, I don't even really truly believe what I'm saying, but I think it's more like the first one. I think he does believe what he's saying. I don't even know if he's sorry that this is the way it is, because he's one of the people that it's better for.
So the exact quote was,
better doesn't always mean better for everyone. It always means worse for some.
Do you feel like this is a true statement?
I've been thinking about that since I heard him say it, trying to think of situations where that were truly win-win, you know, like everybody comes out on top and you get into kind of qualifying what better means. But yeah, I think you can in certain finite relationships. I think you can. Everybody win.
I don't know. Like, I want to think that that could be like it's better for everyone, like the human race. But then I stop and I say, well, but what about like side effects of those medications? It's better for most. But maybe some people die of the side effects of that medication. And so in that case, that would be worse for some, you know, and I like try to think, oh, is there truly ever anything that can truly be better for everyone across the board?
I guess not in like the macrocosm, you know, like
I don't know. I really invite our listeners to try to think hard and please interact with us on any scenario that you can come up with. This is like your brain teaser homework. I know it's summertime, folks, but let's keep our brains going and tell me, do you think there is any scenario in which better can always mean better for all? Or is that just simply impossible? And I know in some of these, you would have to create a hypothetical in which no one took advantage of the system and no one used their control in an abusive way. But like truly, there could be a scenario in which everybody was okay with it and everybody was better off for it. is that possible? Is there a scenario that looks like that? And I think I can think of it in individual circumstances, like very small circumstances. But then I think when you think of it in the, like you said, the macrocosm, I think, oh, but as soon as you gather like a trial study of like 100 people, well, it would have worked out for 90 or 95.
But and the other that's 10 really are stuck doing whatever it is those 90 need done.
Yeah, well, or that it just didn't work out for them and maybe they're worse off for it. For whatever reason, because like I was trying to think about, you know, really finite situations, like I don't say something like surrogacy, like planned surrogacy, where you find somebody who's very happy and willing and open to carrying a baby for another couple in a very positive and very symbiotic kind of way. Like they want to do this and the couple wants the baby. The baby is born, they pass off the baby, they are happy. They are satisfied. They feel like they've done something for another couple and everyone leaves happily. I feel like in situation, if you take just that, you could have very happy outcomes and say, well, look, that's a situation where that was a really happy sitch. But then I feel like if you got a vast number of them together, you would likely find at least some number of like where the birth mother died in birth. And so then that would have been worse off, or the baby turned out to be unwanted or abused in the new situation. Just a variety of issues that could crop up where you say, well, it can't always be best for everybody every time. And I don't know if that's just the nature of life.
You can think of a lot of examples where he is true and it has worked out that way. I mean, pretty sure that's what the Nazis were telling themselves, something like that, you know?
Well, I can tell you that my own mom, who is an RN, her biggest thing that she always said to us kids was think of the greater good. Like if we had to do something like get a shot or something like that, it's think of the greater good. And the greater good, when you really kind of break it down, is really the idea that for the most part, it's better that you do this. But some part of it is going to suck. And it's sort of like if you think about the greater good, in this case, if the human race survives, but 30 women have to be sacrificed for it, was that for the greater good? And like, could that be considered good enough? I think that there's parts of this entire Gilead plan that seem ridiculously abusive to the handmaids and ridiculously convoluted in the way that they handled things. I don't think that it had to get to where they made it. You know, the handmaids could have been treated very nicely. And I don't mean like they had to be princesses, but just treated like absolute peers with the wives.
Going back to what Fred said in this conversation, in their minds, they think they're fine because he said, well, now that women don't have to worry about the stuff in these magazines, you have, he said, respect and protection.
Interesting.
Respect was the first one he chose. If you have another person in charge of you that is fully allowed to hit you with a cattle prod, I don't see how respect figures into the equation.
Or protection. Because right. I thought for a second, I was thinking, you know, we speak a lot about, you know, rape culture and the idea of women being sexually abused and attacked and stuff like that. And so when you look at simply the handmaid's role and simply that one slice, the way that that slice was written, you know, go in pairs, we kill rapists, you know, all this kind of stuff, and we treat them very aggressively. That slice seems like, okay, yeah, like that seems like better protection and more respect for like what you're doing, right? But it's like you only have to just like widen your eye a little bit to say like, but then the commanders are raping them. And then the, you know, like, I mean, it like quickly falls apart. Like, oh my God, but that's not,
and
but that
tagged, didn't work. Like, and cattle and they
yeah,
are
and they're abused in like every cattle. Other way. And it's like, okay, well then that didn't work out at all. This really is a conundrum. I mean, and you could see being a leader of any country. I mean, I throw this out to, again, to our listeners and say, how do you make sure that every single person in your country is happy, healthy, and doing well? Because the reality is that every individual has their different needs. You know, we all have basic needs. And so you can meet like food, shelter, clothing, you know, those types of things. But when you get down to things like relationships and things like that, your government can't help you there. Like I know over in Sweden and Norway, that's considered the happiest people on earth. Those people are considered the most satisfied and content. They also have a much lower expectation of what material belongings they should own, how much space they need as individuals, like kind of if you think of that IKEA mentality. So what if you were born into that society and you were someone who like needed a mansion, huge style, like in your brain, like you just couldn't ever be happy. Then again, well, sorry, Bubba, for the greater good of the country is that everybody lives in the shoebox sized everything with compartments and all these little things. And most people are happy, but it's going to be worse for some. I hope you're not somebody who wants to go above and beyond because you're going to be frowned upon. You know, you're expected to take vacation time with your family and the majority of people feel more well-rounded and that's great. But what if you're somebody who doesn't have a family? Or somebody who simply is a huge go-getter who really thrives on doing something new and fresh and, you know, I don't even expensive all the time. Your personality and your wants would be like pushed down upon by the rest of society. How could you be happy? So it's kind of weird. Like even in the most idyllic situation, you're like, oh, shit. But there's bound to be people who are born who are not okay with the rules are and what the society says you should do. I know for us, like when we go to places, and I won't call them out, but individual places where it just doesn't necessarily suit our lifestyle. When you look around and you can see that people are happy, you get that idea of like, well, this is a nice place to visit, but I wouldn't want to live here. Right?
Yes.
Like you appreciate that they're happy with it, but it's not your cup of tea. So maybe it's the idea that one size can't ever fit all. And so then in that case, you do get that better worse thing. Because when you're trying to make rules for a large group of people, you kind of have to shove that one size fits all shirt on everyone. And some people look awful in those shirts. And some people are swimming in them. And some are too tight. And we all get the same size shirt.
It exposes the naivete of the sons of Jacob thinking that you needed to overthrow the previous government to try to make things, quote unquote, better for some. And you just can't. It's just not. I mean, we're not political scientists here, but I think we're uncovering the idea that, you know, as a government, you can do the best you can. But if you do it like, especially like Gilead, you can see like the rift there between the highs and the lows is huge.
You know? I think that the biggest thing that I hear called out most of the time on Gilead is about choice. And so if you have the choice to be in different size shirts, say I want a small, a medium, a large, but everyone's got to wear the same shirt, okay? Like we all got to buy it out of the same Hanes box here, okay? But at least you have different sizes and maybe different fits or something, which I kind of think is what I hear people say about America as opposed to other countries where they say like, well, at least I have the choice to live in a city or the country or the suburbs or an apartment or a mansion or a houseboat or what, like I have choices. And so long as I have choices, even though my choices are finite, I'm still kind of like a little bit more okay as a human. And that's the thing I think we hear June say a lot, especially in these episodes. And we hear it a lot coming up in this next part with the conversation with Nick in the kitchen. He's giving her such a hard time. And how many times do we hear her say, I didn't have a choice. I didn't have a choice. I don't have a choice in any of this.
This reminds me of a story my mom used to tell me when I was small about when she was small. She was a member of a family with 10 children. And when they would go to McDonald's, there was not a lot of individual ordering. There was 10 cheeseburgers ordered and that's it.
And that makes sense though, right? So in a way it's like, yay, we get to go to McDonald's.
Well, some kids don't like cheese and some kids don't like onions and some kids don't like pickles, but they got 10 standard issue cheeseburgers.
And don't you know those first couple of times when there was like two or three, they like tried. And then at one point, they're just like, you know, it got to like five or six and you're like, you know what?
Right. Scrape it off.
I'm done trying to do this. And so, I mean, I really appreciate that. I appreciate the concept of, you know, being a teacher, I feel the same way. You know, you have 22 kindergartners looking at you and it's like, 22 cheeseburgers, please. You know, like scrape off what you don't like, you guys, because it gets nutty, right? Mm-hmm. So let's get into Nick and the kitchen. I had a real hard time with this scene because I really honestly felt like it was...
Well, everyone's all keyed up for her to be pregnant, for one thing. So she comes out and she barfs and Nick's like, oh, barfing. Yes, barfing's good.
Gross.
But after the barfing ceremony, she's kind of had it with Nick. His whole secretive, you know, persona guy, you know, and she's like, finally just asks, point blank, because that's what she does at the end of episodes. She just says what's on her mind. And today her on her mind is, are you an I? Now, Nick, for me, I mean, I'm not exactly Mr. Nick. I don't have a Nick poster in my locker or anything like that. But this scene, he played so cool. Yes. Now get to bed or I'll report you.
Do you think that was meant to be kind of like one of those, like, I'll spank you kind of like weird comments like that?
I do not. I think it was more like he still wanted to keep some ambiguity about it. Like he was like, yeah, sure, I'm an I. Get to bed or I'll report you now. You know, like that.
But so jokey though? Or like, so that's what I'm saying though. Like, was it meant like tongue in cheek? Like I would run after the kids and pinch their butts on the way up the stairs. Like I'm not like
tongue in cheek,
actually hurting them.
Definitely flirty.
Yeah. So I don't know. Again, those interactions between June and Nick when, I don't know, I'm not super duper into them. I like them together and I understand both of them. To me, it's like every single World War II, really even the Under the Dome type of stories that we read where those containment stories where it's like people need to find others to cling to just to survive. I understand it 100%. I get it. And it's totally believable that that is exactly what would happen. I don't like it when it gets too soap opera-y. That's all. Because it's like the writing gets in the way of the words. And I just feel like it's like sometimes I just want her to talk a little more naturally, especially when it's just her and Nick, because all the rest of the time we have this really prescribed language that I really like it when they just speak very naturally when they're together.
I'm not going to fault any of the actors exactly, but I will say that the directors in this show do seem to give the actors room to run. You know what I mean?
Not sure. I mean, I wish that would be a fascinating part to know how much they're being manipulated. Like if they're stopping at the end of every scene and saying, no, I want you to stare into the camera and do it this time. Or if those are choices that the actors are making. I don't know if we could discern that at this point. I would love to know.
Yeah, that's something that, you know, we don't have an exact policy on it. Because like with the leftovers, we absorb some amount of behind the camera information. You know, and expose it as it becomes relevant. But for The Handmaids, except for me having read the book, I'll admit I have not gone out of my way to look up.
Well, there hasn't been any opportunities for us yet. Like, so you guys know we go to television festivals. There hasn't been anything yet anywhere near us at all where we've had an opportunity to go to like a panel and find out like, how are you doing this? I'm very much expecting and hoping that Austin Television Festival next year, 2018, will be offering a Handmaid's Tale panel. I mean, Hulu is a sponsor. And
it just makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I would take anything. I would take a director, a showrunner, costume, set, producing, talent, anything. I would take anything to get somebody to tell us a little bit more about how they made the decisions to do things and how the tone on some things, you know, like how I say sometimes it goes from a very serious subject matter and then sometimes it can like teeter on soap opera. On accident. And it's really hard, I think, to balance that. And it's a tough thing for the characters, I'm sure, and tough to write for them and deliver where you don't come off melodramatic when it is a very serious and dramatic situation.
It's up to the director to pull that out.
You're right. You're totally
right. The actor's going to give what they think is the right performance, but it's still up to the director to say, nah, we're getting a little mushy here. Yeah. We need to tighten up.
I completely agree. I think that Mimi Leader from The Leftovers, she is the director of many, and then she is the supervising director overall in terms of sort of the overall tone of everything.
Right.
And I feel very much like she has let us in on a lot of conversations where she explains how the director has so much control that way. The way that they light scenes, where they put the camera, whether it's an extreme close-up or whether it's a landscape, and how to use the different back and forth between characters or staying on one character and shooting over a shoulder and all those things, how it impacts how we as the audience absorb those scenes.
Mm-hmm.
I have a much different appreciation for how much control the director has. I know it sounds obvious they're the director, right? But you think, oh, well, but the words are on the page. you know, the set directions there, everything's like laid out. How much control could you have? But you realize, oh, like, oh my God, if you put the camera over here or above or below, it affects just everything. It's sure. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Let's wrap up the Nick and June interaction for this episode. We have Nick's that night. So now she's had two formal ceremonial type sexcapades that day. And at night, she decides, like, screw it on all this. Like, she is going to take matters into her own hands and sort of, I'm going to say, like, do this right, if you will, right? So she goes and has what you considered a very long scene for us to watch.
Yes, I thought it was very long for a TV episode, for a movie. If you think about the way that sex is portrayed in TV and movies right now, and then compare it to something like, say, something in the 80s or 90s. Those movies had sex scenes. They weren't particularly realistic or anything like that, but there were still naked bodies, you know, writhing around on each other for several minutes on screen. You know?
This is typically, would you say three pumps and done? Honestly, like if you watch like anything on just regular old like network TV, you're going to get like pump, 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 roll off, right?
Something like that.
Pretty much.
Yeah, you get the... You get the denouement of the of the engagement. But that's not the way it used to be. And now that's the way it kind of is. Except, you know, HBO does kind of embellish a little bit. But for the most part, not a lot. Not a lot of multi-positional kind of stuff. And this was all that.
I think this was important, though, because of course, we needed to see that this wasn't going to be like a wham, bam, thank you, ma'am kind of situation, right? Like there had to be the foreplay. We had to see them actually get on the bed. And then we had to see the most important part is her getting on top, because that is what she had told Luke the whole beginning part of the episode, is that she likes to be on top. So this was like the first time that she was taking any control in this scenario. And it was like, yay, like uplifting that it was like, oh my God, this is the first time she's had sex in how long, that it's actually hopefully going to be good for her, you know?
Yeah.
I understand what you're saying to the point of like, we're not accustomed to seeing it like that anymore.
And maybe it's that we had friends over that night and I was feeling a little squirmy.
Very long to watch with friends. I agree with you on that. When we say long, what we mean to say is like drawn out from like, it usually just shows you clips and then you move on kind of thing. Like it could have said like hours later, but like we don't have to see it all, you know?
Right.
So, yeah. So, okay, well, I'm glad for Nick and June, and I'm glad that June is finally sort of getting her groove back a little bit there. That's a really good thing. I feel happier for her, and hopefully that she's feeling a little bit better. But we had that one section of the episode that we haven't really touched on, which is about Emily.
Right. Emily.
A.K.A. Old Off Glen.
Old Off Glen. She is back. She is now of Stephen, or...
Yes.
Okay, she is now of Stephen. The wind is out of her sails in a pretty major way for most of the episode. She's not able to talk about any of that other Mayday stuff. She's been cut off, and June keeps trying to check in with her. I guess it is probably accurate. I mean, the new Off Glen is like, stop talking to her. You're going to get me in trouble just by you talking to her. Do you think that's real or just Off Glen?
Probably,
being a bitch?
Yeah. No, because of how, like, think about how Offred got in trouble and got beat up for not tattling on Off Glen. So, sure, old Off Glen, Emily. So, sure, yeah, the new Off Glen would get in trouble if Offred was off chatting up Emily. Yes, your partner is supposed to keep you in line.
And
so, yeah, that's fair.
The current Off Glen thinks Gilead is okay.
Which, okay, so this was like a really fascinating glimpse into a whole nother thing. The idea that what is worse for some is better for others, right? This kind of flops it the other way, right? So June had a good life, and even Off Glen, the new one, kind of points out, like, I bet you had a Nordstrom card. I bet you did this and that. Like, you know, she pointed out, like, your life was good before, but I had a really bad life, and I was on drugs, and I'm clean now, and I was getting sexually assaulted, and I was doing all these awful things.
Sound like she was homeless.
And now I have a safe, happy place, and my missus is nice, and all this stuff, so I need you to not fuck it up for me. Wow, you know, that's like, okay, that's another glimpse into this entire scene. Did it occur to you much that, given that these girls are referred to in these really negative ways as sluts and stuff like that, that some of these girls may have been in these terrible homeless type situations?
It did not occur to me that the handmade life would be an improvement for any person. It does kind of remind me of our Facebook group, Gilead Online. You cannot count out every different kind of perspective on the issue. You know, that page does not have just one single voice that all agrees on the exact right way to handle the issue of things like feminism or whatever. People have all different kinds of takes on all subjects. And this is just another one of those examples to say, worse for you is better for me. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's an interesting flip, a really interesting flip. I appreciated them giving us a little slice of the pie because that felt like a little bit more balanced. Because again, you know, it put that in your face of like, oh, crap, you know. Now there's people who were worse off and this actually brought them to a better place. Like, oh my God, how do we keep making the scale work out here of like, what should we have been doing? You know, what are the pros and cons? I don't even know anymore. What did you think about Emily's big car adventure?
I thought she should have turned left at some point instead of just taking the block a couple times.
So what I heard from other people online was that it was like an enclosed situation. Now, I don't really get that because, I mean, surely the car came from somewhere.
Outside that block, yes.
Well, outside, it seemed like it was like a rotary almost kind of situation. But, I mean, it would have to shoot off somewhere, right?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, where were the wives coming or going from? So, yeah, I'm with you. Do you think it was about getting away or do you think it was about flexing her muscle?
Getting away at first and then she couldn't. So then she did the best she could with what she had.
What did you think that she actually glanced over to June and June nodded at her right before she hit the accelerator?
I don't know that June meant run over a guy's head. I think she just meant like Thelma and Louise, just keep going.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I'm with you. Okay.
Not the same thing as run over a guy's head.
Yeah, no, that was pretty gruesome, right?
Yeah, it popped like a melon. I mean, it was...
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, it was something.
It was something. Well, so do you suspect we'll see Emily for the rest of the season?
I think they're going to lock her away. If they don't end up just stringing her up, then she may unfortunately see the worst side of their need to keep their breeding stock alive.
I'm super scared for her because I don't feel like anything good's going to happen at all. Well, we really look forward to hearing more from you guys. So please give us some feedback. What do you think is going to happen to Emily? Will we see her season 2? Is she going to make it to the end here? What is going to happen to her? Also, what do you think about this concept of better for some means worse for others? What does this mean? What does this mean? We'll talk to you guys later. Thanks.
Thanks. Catch us on iTunes or your preferred podcast software. Our website, dailyreview.com. That's D-A-L-E-Y review.com. Facebook or Twitter or wherever you find us. Please leave us a comment and a rating to let us know what you think of the show.
Thanks for listening, pod people. Thanks for listening to my mom and dad.
You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. Just go home, folks.